This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, even for devoted Christians, reading every word of the Bible may be a once-in-a-lifetime challenge. In a minute, we'll hear from a man who decided to copy the entire book by hand, and he tells us he's not even particularly religious. We think you'll be intrigued by what he has to say in a few minutes. But first, we want to check in on some of the top political stories of the week with two of our seasoned political observers. Kelly Goff is a political correspondent for TheRoot.com. That's an online publication that features a variety of African-American voices. Here with us in Washington, D.C. is Mary Kate Carey. She's a former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. She's now a columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report. Welcome back to you both. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Great to be back. Yeah,
thanks for having us.
Let's start with a big win in South Carolina for the former governor, Mark Sanford, a Republican. He left office, I think it's fair to say, in disgrace after an extramarital affair became public. He became an enduring late-night talk show punchline after he disappeared for almost a week, saying he'd been hiking the Appalachian Trail, but it later turned out that he was lying because he was, in fact, visiting his mistress in Argentina. This week, though, Sanford won a special election for a congressional seat that he once held. And here's a clip from that victory speech.
Some guy came up to me the other day. He said, "You look a lot like Lazarus." and I say that because if it was just about market-based ideas and limited government, this campaign would have been easily won a long time ago.
You know, speaking of that, Mary Kate, interesting ironies here. Speaking of late-night punchlines,
yes.
The Democratic challenger was Elizabeth Colbert Bush, who's Stephen Colbert's sister, but this is also a district that hasn't elected a Democrat in three decades. So should we be surprised or not? And are you popping the cork? Is it another Republican win, or is it a little bit more icky than that?
Well, a win's a
win. Technical term, icky.
Icky. High-tech political term. No, I think a win's a win, and Sanford ran a great campaign. And what he did was, he was right to recognize that this wasn't just about fiscal conservatism versus an Obama liberal. What he realized was this was about forgiveness. And his line, for example, that he wanted to thank the God of second and third and fourth chances, that plays well in South Carolina. It probably wouldn't have played well in New York City. So he understood his electorate. He was smart when the national establishment kind of turned his back on him. He went and got the endorsements of Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, Lindsey Graham, and that made it safe for local Republicans to vote for him. And that was very smart. He ran an Avis, We Try Harder kind of campaign. A lot more turnout, a lot more events. He just did a great job.
Kelly Goff, how do you read it?
Well, I have to say, I met actually Governor Sanford at the Republican National Convention, and it was really interesting, the turn of events, because at that time, he certainly wasn't a superstar. So he was just milling about the crowd, and I stopped him and asked him about his wedding plans. He wouldn't give me any scoop about when those would be taking place or what she'd be wearing, because I did ask. But he was charming and, you know, a nice guy. I have to say, though, that I think a tweet from Daily Kos sort of summarized my feelings and those of a lot of others, which is that it's not that we're against forgiveness. It's not that I actually believe that someone's personal life in terms of what's going on with their spouse should always be used as a measuring stick in terms of whether or not they make a great elected official. Because I'm sure we've all voted for plenty who are great on the job and not so great personally in their personal lives. But what the tweet said is, well, this makes it official when Republicans say they're for family values. They're really just saying they're against gay families. And I think that we have to talk about that, right? Because for some reason, when people say we support family values, we want people who are good, God-fearing Christians in their family lives, and then you support someone who behaves this way, but then you turn around and say either a gay candidate's not appropriate or gay people shouldn't be able to adopt children, it really does raise the issue of hypocrisy and where that fits in the whole conservative idealism about family values.
Is this any different than Bill Clinton, though? I mean, there are a lot of people, right, who said, I don't approve of his personal behavior, but since I don't approve of his personal behavior, I'll just be sure not to date him.
Well, but the thing is, I don't think Bill Clinton ever used his personal life to define his politics. And I think that's what a lot of people have a problem with, is if someone like Newt Gingrich wasn't saying, I don't consider gay families the same, and therefore in terms of adopting children or having the same benefits as married couples, I think people would say, hey, it's not my business. It's just not my business. Let him work it out at home. When people make that a part of their policymaking decisions, it then screams hypocrisy and it makes it hard to ignore.
Okay.
The only thing I'd say to that is final thought there.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Sanford's known as a fiscal conservative, not necessarily a social conservative. So I'm not sure he was leading with his chin on this by putting himself out there as a good example.
But
for
did he vote for Clinton's impeachment, though? Was he in the House at the time that President Clinton
came up
for
check.
Impeachment? That's the other question,
yeah.
Sort of, I think a lot of people.
Well, I also think we know where he stands on gay marriage, so I'll leave it at that.
Okay. All right. Well, speaking of, you know, the kind of that line between what's personal and what's political, current Governor Chris Christie was in the news this week, the New Jersey governor, because he disclosed that through lap band surgery in February, he shed some 40 pounds. Let's listen briefly.
I turned 50 years old and it made me think. I got confronted with, you know, your own, you know, mortality as you start to age. And so from my perspective, you know, this is about Mary Pat and the kids and me. It's really not about anybody else. And it shouldn't be about anybody else.
Kelly, I'll go to you first on this. This is one of those things that intrigues me because on the one hand, we are all women in this conversation at the moment. Any woman who's been around, in or around politics at any point has talked about this sort of the unfair double standard that women seem to face. Their appearance is scrutinized in ways that just seem never to happen to men. And yet here's a man whose appearance is not just scrutinized, but constantly discussed.
Yes.
With no shame at all. And so how do you feel about this? Should you have even had this conversation?
Well, you know, look, obesity seems to sort of be the great equalizer, right? Because we know the studies in terms of how that affects people's perception. I will throw out something else that I found interesting in coming to the show today, is that there's a book called Beauty Pays, where an economist actually found that being more attractive actually ends up benefiting men more professionally in the long term than women, which I was shocked by. But he talked about this in the Wall Street Journal in terms of pay. Now, how that translates on the campaign trail, I'm not so sure. But we do know that there's sort of a perspective on people who are obese in this country, and it's not a flattering one. And so I think whether you're a male candidate or a female candidate would present a challenge. We saw Mike Huckabee do something similar in when he was prepping for a presidential run. So I think that, you know, it's for his family, but I also think he had strategists who are saying, if you really want to do this, if you're serious, you need to address this issue.
But Mary Kate, is the difference, though, that people are talking about him running for president, and that is there a legitimate question about whether he would have the stamina
right
to fulfill that office? And right. So if you're just joining us, we're speaking with two of our trusted political observers, Mary Kate Carey, who served in the George H.W. Bush administration. She now writes and blogs about politics. Also, Kelly Goff, the political correspondent for TheRoot.com. Mary Kate, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, I interviewed with Dick Cheney to join his campaign in 1996, and then he ultimately decided not to run for president. And I think a lot of his decision was based on the fact that he had these terrible heart problems. And I think there was sort of a question with voters of, if I vote for this guy, is he going to keel over? And I think that probably comes into the matrix of Chris Christie's decision making. And in Dick Cheney's case, he couldn't do anything to fix that heart problem, but Chris Christie could. And so I think if he had the opportunity, he's taken it. And this is probably one of the reasons why he's doing it, just like Mike Huckabee. Before he ran for president. And these are all men we're talking about. These are not women. Because in my mind, obesity is a health issue, not an appearance issue.
Can I also say, too,
sure.
By mm-hmm. the way, I love her for saying the term keel over.
Thank you very much.
But I also think, too, that the uncomfortable thing we're not supposed to say out loud, but it's a reality, is that obesity sort of falls in the same thing of some of the other unpleasantries, like smoking, which we, you know President Obama struggled with, which is if people perceive it as a discipline issue. And fair or not, I think that that does sort of linger in the back of the minds of some Americans. And that's the other reason that I think candidates feel more compelled to sort of address it.
Let me just clarify one more thing before we take on our last topic, which is that according to The Washington Post, former Governor Mark Sanford did vote to impeach President Clinton in the wake of his known affair with Monica Lewinsky. So
that's interesting.
Just for whatever that means.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
for whatever that means. And okay. Finally, the big news this week, and I apologize, we don't have a lot of time to talk about what is a fairly complicated and emotional issue. The other big news this week were the hearings on Capitol Hill regarding the incident at the United States Embassy in Benghazi, Libya, which resulted in the death of three Americans. I don't want to imply that by using the word incident that I'm trivializing what was in fact a terrible event. But it seems as though conservatives have been raising questions about this for a very long time. And Mary Kay Carey, you know, is it fair to ask? I think there are a lot of people on the left who would say that this is just political theater to embarrass the administration. And I'd like to ask whether you think that might be true or not.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of people on the left trying to say nothing to see here. Please move on. And the larger purpose, though, beyond political theater is the question of, is leading from behind in the Middle East working? And that's where I think it's starting to become, the answer is no. They've got two narratives that are developing through all of this. One is the administration soft on terrorism? And their initial responses when they first won't say something's a terrorist attack, when it's pretty obvious to everybody that it is, whether we're talking about Boston or Fort Hood or Benghazi. And the second is, can the administration get their facts right? And those two things are coming together in a way that's making the White House and the State Department look very vulnerable. And it's spreading now beyond – originally it was sort of a Fox News story, and now NBC's on it, Lisa Myers, what's the other one? I'm sorry.
Cheryl Atkinson for CBS.
That's
sure.
the one. And so it is getting some momentum, and I think it's because of those two narratives about terrorism and the truth.
Everybody's blood sugar must be low because we're all forgetting things. So it was actually four Americans. This is not a joke. I apologize. There's actually four Americans who lost their lives in that incident. And Kelly Goff, your point of view about this?
Look, it's a tragedy, and I don't want us to ever forget mm-hmm. that there were lives lost, and so I never want to come across as diminishing that because it's not something to be diminished. I will say, however, though, for me, the most shocking sort of revelation to come out of all this is how much our government is relying on the news media to help them define policy agenda. I mean, that's to me what's been really stunning to come out of these hearings is that even the report from Senator Collins and Senator Lieberman, who are not defenders of the administration, was that the media was playing a role in how all of the elected officials and even the intelligence community was sort of talking about this. What I will say, though, is in terms of political theater, the reality is everyone knows that Hillary Clinton is unstoppable. Republicans have even, you know, said that on and off the record. And the only thing that could possibly tarnish her in terms of gliding into the White House would really be something like this, like being perceived as having a soft on terror role that cost the lives of Americans. So while this is a serious story, I do believe the response to it was a debacle in terms of how it was publicly discussed in the media. I don't think Hillary Clinton was at fault. I do think people are going to try to tie it to her because that's the only thing that would prevent her from making it to the White House.
Unfortunately, we don't have time to talk more about this. I want to hear next time we talk about why you think it's so important for the administration to say terrorist. Is that like a sort of a do you get brownie points for being first to use a certain word? I don't know. So you can explain more about that.
Okay.
All right. Mary Kay Carey is a former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. She's now columnist and blogger with U.S. News and World Report. Kelly Goff is political correspondent for TheRoot.com. That's an online publication that focuses on issues of particular interest to the Black community. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, Philip Patterson decided he wanted to get to know his Bible better, in part to come to terms with ideas that had always troubled him on issues like the role of women and slavery.
The Bible is written by men who are desperately trying to understand the world in which they live, as we are today, still.
Now he tells us more about how he came to peace with the Holy Book by writing it out word for word. More on that in just a minute on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. In a few minutes, You Tell Us More, editor Ahmad Omar steps to the mic to share some of your comments about stories we've covered recently. That's Back Talk, and it's coming up. But first, it's time for Faith Matters. That's our weekly conversation about matters of faith and spirituality. And today, we are going to meet a man who took a unique path to getting to know his Bible. Now, a lot of people try to read the Bible from cover to cover, but Philip Patterson went a step further. As we speak, he is just two verses away from completing a handwritten version of the King James Bible, and he is with us now. Philip Patterson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what made you start this massive project?
Well, at the very root of it, it was simply that I wanted always to know what was in it. And I don't have the mental bandwidth to be able to sit down and read something as complex as the Bible and then come away with any understanding at all. And that was always the underlying thing. And I wondered how it was we went into court and swore on that Bible. And people don't really know what's in it. They know the stories, but, you know, they don't know what's between the lines. They don't know what the atmosphere is that's created. And then later on, I had a friend who was a Muslim, and we're comparing notes one day. He's got his Quran in his lap, and I've got my Bible in mine, and we're seeing what the similarities are and what the differences are. And he said to me that in Islam, there's a tradition of handwriting the Quran, much as the Hebrews, the Jews, handwrite the Torah. He said, you don't have that in Christianity? I said, no, because the Bible is really too big.
It's too long.
And he said to me,
can't do it.
He said, well, then you should do it. And at that moment, I thought so many things came together for me. It was a great, I thought the project was absolutely inspired. And I would finally find out what was in it.
You know, it's true that a lot of people do. You'll see people in church sometimes. They'll say a lot of church bulletins have a space for notes.
Right.
And you do find people kind of taking, you know, notes throughout a service.
Yes.
Something that they want to think about later. Did you used to do that?
No.
No?
No.
No, that wasn't you.
I wasn't that kind of, let's put it this way. I wasn't that kind of agnostic. I have been a person who questions everything. And the moment that I matured enough to be able to think on my own, I kind of rejected the religious tenets of my childhood and had to come back to it on my own terms.
I was going to ask you about that because I understand that you do not or you did not consider yourself particularly devout. I'm wondering about the exercise of writing out the whole Bible. Did you find yourself, did that take you in a certain direction theologically or spiritually?
Spiritually, yes. I'd have to do this project a couple of more times to be able to tell you about theologically, although I did come to a place finally about Jesus. So we can talk about that in a moment. But
well, tell me now.
Yeah. Right. We are doing an interview. I had always been, or certainly as I got old enough to think on my own, I had been very skeptical about the whole Jesus being God thing and rising from the dead and all that stuff. You know, it was a problem for me. It was a stumbling block. Well, in the writing of the New Testament, I guess the thunderbolt hit me during the writing of the epistles, where I suddenly realized that maybe it doesn't matter to me if Jesus is the Son of God or even divine, but this Jesus that we talk about in the Bible changed the world from what it had been to at least a world where we have hope now for something better. And I figure whoever that guy's related to, he deserves to be the Messiah. So I am now able to at least recognize Jesus Christ as certainly my Messiah. Because what I've experienced and what I've learned and what I'm able to feel, I couldn't have come to any other way except through Jesus.
How did you keep going all this time? Were you ever tempted to give up?
Never. That was easy because I knew once I started, I would not be able to stop or just give it up. Because if you get to, the middle of Isaiah and you quit, you don't have anything. You've got a Bible that's not a Bible. What is that? So much paper, and you become a person who said, well, you know, I started writing the Bible once, and then I gave it up. I don't want to be that person.
I understand that you've also been struggling through the years with some health issues. What's one reason we're speaking to you at home?
Oh, yes.
How did you manage that? I understand that there were times, do I have it right that you actually worked on this, you know, hours a day? I mean, hours a day.
Yeah.
How did
you
manage that while still managing some of these health issues that I understand have sapped your strength at times?
Well, starting with the HIV piece and moving into all of the galaxy of things that came as a result, which was one of the reasons I was uniquely qualified to do this project, because I could be very productive and sit. So that's how I managed. I did have to put the project aside sometimes for months at a time to recover from various and sundry ailments that would plague me. And I was always, in those times, I was feeling very guilty that I wasn't doing the project. And then slowly, I'd gain my strength back. And, you know, there I was, great guns. But in the beginning, I also worked 10 to 18 hours a day. You know, that was not uncommon. And of course, now, fortunately, I'm finished, but I can only manage probably about 6 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I squeeze out a little bit more, you know, willing to stay up all night.
Why the King James Version? There are other, more contemporary versions.
I know.
People feel that, you know, the understandings, the theological understandings of the time were those of the time, but that there are more contemporary translations that some people feel just have the benefit of more recent scholarship. They think maybe a little bit more clarity.
Yes.
Why that one?
That one was because I was interested in the poetry, and I really appreciated the way that the syntax flowed in that particular translation. I looked into some of the more contemporary translations and even some of the old translations, you know, translations from other religions, and I was sold on the King James. I mean, it was just no question for me. I'm also, you know, a Shakespeare fan, so the language I'm very comfortable with.
Is there a particular verse that even now you can't shake?
There's a verse that has always been with me, and it has had different meaning to me over time, and that is, love thy neighbor as thyself for the love of God. And in terms of a design for living, that's really the bottom line. You know, if we start there, we can end there gracefully. It's just that when we lose sight of those words, that our vanity kicks in. We want, we covet, you know. So, yes, that verse, love thy neighbor as thyself for the love of God, that is the verse that stays with me the most.
What about some of the passages that people today find particularly challenging? And there are many. I mean, there are passages that, you know, call for women to be silent in the church. There are passages that condemn homosexuality. There are passages that suggest that slaves should be obedient to their masters, for the kingdom of heaven is coming. All of those are things that I think in your own life, if you don't mind my mentioning, you might find, you know, troubling among lots. And I just wondered how you struck that when you came to some of those passages.
I don't necessarily subscribe to the facts that the Bible is the word of God, that God whispered in someone's ear and said this, this, and this. My belief on that is the Bible is written by men who are desperately trying to understand the world in which they live, as we are today still. And you can imagine what it was like for them that many thousands of years ago. So, you know, people still have those thoughts, still have those ideas. Women are still marginalized. Homosexuals are still marginalized. But I am not able to believe that the God that I discovered in this Bible would support those ideas.
Does it make you sad that the friend who inspired this project. I understand that it was a longtime friend of yours.
Yes, 20-year partner.
20-year partner passed away before you were able to finish. Does that make you sad that he wasn't able to see you finish?
No, not really, because in those 20 years, you know, it had been an exuberant and loving relationship. And once he was gone, I knew that there was nothing else for me to do except just continue on with my life. Mm. And that was complete, because I had so much joy with him up until the end. You know, his family came around and were very kind to me, where, you know, they had been trying to make me disappear before, but it all ended gracefully and well. So, yeah, do I miss him? I do. But I don't necessarily feel like I would have needed for him to see the end of this. First of all, he would be totally nuts over all of these TV and radio interviews.
Well, thank you for taking the time. And it, you know, it's one of those mundane, ridiculous reporter questions, but I have to ask, how do you feel now that you're about to finish?
Serene. Totally serene. Not like without a few butterflies here and there, but I feel totally serene, you know, because it's what I set out to do. And I did it.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
That was Philip Patterson. He is just two verses away from finishing a handwritten version of the King James Bible. And he was kind enough to join us from his home in Philmont, New York. Congratulations, Mr. Patterson. I know you're going to have a celebration, or should I call it that, to acknowledge the end of this project. So we certainly wish you well.
A total party.
Total party. Well, we know it will be a great one.
Thank you.
And now it's time for Back Talk. That's where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere. Editor Ahmad Omar is back with us. What's going on today, Ahmad?
Hey, Michelle. How's it going? We got a lot of emails this week about a conversation you had about the rapper Danny Brown. Now, if you missed it, there was this conversation about whether he was sexually assaulted by one of his fans at a concert. This woman in the crowd performed a sexual act on him, and there was a big debate about whether it was consensual or he was the victim of a sexual assault. Now, our panel mainly said that he may well have been sexually assaulted, but that's not the response that we got from listeners, Michelle. A lot of people wrote in with comments like this one from Don Dupree of Detroit. He says, I thought that everyone saying he was sexually assaulted was pretty messed up. I know females that have went through hell because they were hurt in that way, and I just feel it was unfair to them. I understand where everyone was coming from on the consent front, but there are so many people who get forced into acts that ruin their lives.
Thank you, Don, and thanks to everybody who wrote in on this subject. We got a lot of responses on email and also a lot on Twitter, so there's a lot to talk about there. I just want to take a minute to mention that I appreciate all the emails and tweets I received in response to the essay I wrote earlier this week about my brother. Very much appreciated.
Yeah, we did get a lot of tweets about that, Michelle, and one that really exemplified all of them came from Kristen Crane from Providence, Rhode Island. She says, the Can I Just Tell You segment of Tell Me More is always a favorite part for me. I just want to give Michelle a hug some days, like today.
Oh, thank you. I will gratefully receive that. We also got email about a story we covered yesterday, right?
Yeah, so we talked about the immigration bill that's being proposed in the Senate by the so-called Gang of Eight, and economist Julianne Malveau had this to say.
The fact is that the way we allow people to immigrate has been patently unfair just across the board. Michelle, Canadian people immigrate by walking across the border, and because they're white people, they are not subject to the kind of racial profiling that, let's say, a Latino is.
That really got the letters flowing from our Canadian listeners. Pat Menon from Ontario told us this. First, Canadians are proud that they're a very diverse nation composed of citizens of all races and colors. For example, in 2006, 47% of Toronto's population reported themselves as being part of a visible minority. Second, he says crossing the border for a shopping trip or vacation requires proper documentation. And he says third, this is an example of how little our closest neighbor knows about our country. I do hope that you will take a moment to correct these misconceptions.
Okay, consider it done. Thank you, Pat. Anything else?
Yeah, so we talked about the first woman on the FBI list of most wanted terrorists earlier this week. She goes by the name Assata Shakur. Now, our guest said that Shakur's brother, a man by the name of Mutulu Shakur, helped her escape from prison. Well, it turns out they're not really brother and sister, even though that's a common misconception. There is an interesting connection, though. That man, Mutulu Shakur, is the late rapper Tupac Shakur's stepfather.
Okay, thanks for that, Ahmad. And of course, remember at Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can visit us online at npr.org/tellmemore. Please remember to leave us your name. We're on Twitter. Just look for Tell Me More NPR. Thanks, Ahmad.
Thank you.
Coming up, you've seen Charles Ramsey just about everywhere on television talking about how he helped save the kidnapped victims in Cleveland and why he never had reason to suspect the accused kidnapper, Ariel Castro.
Yeah. Nothing exciting about him. Well, until today.
But the new reports about Charles Ramsey's less than pristine past change what you think about him. The Barbershop Guys weigh in on that and other news of the week. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer and culture critic Jimmy Israel, with us in Washington, D.C. Also here in Washington, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, with us from Boston, healthcare consultant and contributor to the National Review magazine, Neil Minkoff. Also with us, Michael Skolnick. He's editor-in-chief of GlobalGrind.com, with us from New York City. Take it, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Fellas,
hey, we're doing
on?
Good. Just, how you doing?
Just popping some tags because I only got $20 in my pocket.
That's what's up.
Wow. there's espresso in the water today, and I'm feeling it. All right, let's get things started. You know, everyone's had their eyes on my hometown of Cleveland this week. If somehow you haven't heard, three missing women were found in the same house this week. They were allegedly kidnapped about 10 years ago, right, Michelle?
You know, I remember when this first happened, Jimmy, you were just ecstatic. I remember you talked about
was
that for a minute.
Yeah,
just...
yeah. I mean, people that know me, for what it's worth, I mean, I love my hometown because my family is there, but I'm not a big fan of Cleveland. This is one of the very first times in a long time I feel like I can hold my head high. You know, I've never been so proud to be a Clevelander as now. You know,
put your Browns jersey on.
Right. But why? What is it? Stop.
I mean,
but why is it? Because you just feel the way the community's rallied around these women, or what is it
this story had the right ending. And mm-hmm. and well, when I first heard, I heard about it in the early morning hours Monday, and I shed a tear. I mean, I have a daughter, I have children, and if they had been gone for 10 years and reemerged, I don't know. I mean, it was amazing. Good time to be a Clevelander.
I hear you. Well, just to catch people up who may not be following all the facts of this case as closely as everyone else, as we know, one of the women, Amanda Berry, escaped. She alerted the police. Authorities found there were two other women in the home. She immediately called attention to them. Unfortunately, I don't know if it's unfortunate or I don't know how to describe this, but that it does appear that the 6-year-old girl who was also rescued with Amanda Berry, the preliminary DNA tests that show that she is the daughter of the suspected kidnapper, Ariel Castro. Well, you know, this has so many threads to it, Jimmy. Why don't
right.
you just, you know, pick up the thread where you started it and just say what are your other thoughts about this?
You know,
this?
People wonder how this could have occurred. I used to live not far from where this occurred. And, you know, it's the kind of place where the pizza man doesn't deliver and the police, you had to call them 3 and 4 times, you know, to get any kind of response. So that's how this could have happened. And it's the kind of place where the neighbors don't necessarily trust each other. This couldn't have happened in Shaker Heights or Cleveland Heights, where this man's boarded up, kind of disheveled home would have attracted the attention of he would have gotten fined for it. You know, this could have only happened in the poorest of neighborhoods of Cleveland.
Interesting.
Michael Skolnick, you've been following this. Your reaction, brother.
Yeah, I think you had it right. I think it was an incredible ending. I got to bring up my man Charles Ramsey. Who heard the screams of Amanda Berry and ran to the door and kicked it down and helped her get out and gave to me one of the greatest interviews that we've seen in a long time. My man really came to the rescue, and not only came to the rescue, he was proud of what he had done. Even a 911 call when they asked him to give his name or his number if he wanted to, he said, "Of course, I'm give my name, my number." He was so proud of what he had done, and I think that we need to applaud people like that who stand up and are not afraid to go to a house, as you said, had plastic bags over the windows and had never seen anyone come out of it. Charles came to the rescue and is a hero.
I took some issue with that early on because he certainly a good Samaritan, but I'm not sure if he did anything that any other black man wouldn't have done walking down the street necessarily. I'm not taking anything away from him, but I don't know if I say he's exceptional. He doesn't deserve a cape on his back. I think his assessment that he was just a dude that did what he had to do at that time is the correct read. I think another dude walking down the street would have done the exact same thing. I believe that. Okay. Because I'm from Cleveland. I know my city.
Okay.
So can I jump in? I agree that a lot of people have done the same thing. I think that the reason we focused on him so much is he was so gregarious and so different, and it was a way of focusing on the case without focusing on the horror. That was my take on it, it was the ultimate feel-good distraction. So if we focus on, is he a hero or isn't he a hero, or is he a great interview or is he kind of out there, we don't need to pay attention to what happened in this horrific basement in conditions we can't possibly imagine that shouldn't be happening next door to anybody. We'll just focus on the sideshow.
Dr. Neil, thank you for that. A-Train,
pointing out, remember, Neil is trained as a doctor, so you weren't being funny there.
Right.
I didn't mention that at the beginning, but he is trained as a doctor. It's an interesting perspective. Arslan, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, my take on that was that, he kind of became this internet star, not just because he was gregarious and stuff, but also because this is a guy from the side of the tracks that most people that watching him on the news would cross the street to avoid. And this was an opportunity to kind of look and marvel at this cultural attaché from the dark side, and I resent that, frankly.
Okay.
No, I would resent that too. For me, the most poignant part of Charles Ramsey's interview was when he said, quote, "When a little pretty white woman runs into the arms of a black man, you know something's wrong."
And he was just signifying. I mean, he wasn't dropping no social science. He was saying something
but I think,
say in any barbershop in America.
But I think there is some social science to this. Obviously, you look at the historic case of Emmett Till, who was a 14-year-old teenager in Mississippi who was murdered in 1955 for allegedly flirting with a white woman. So, there is this microcosm of, what men of color in this country have had to deal with in terms of social interactions with people from, quote unquote, the other side of the tracks. And so, for me, I think that really resonated, in terms, we know that there's no Good Samaritan laws in most states. You don't really have to do something if you know that a crime is being committed. He did something because, he did it out of the goodness of his heart. But I thought that one quote really, really resonated with me.
Well, to the point where it's now been auto-tuned. I mean, he as a character, and that quote itself has been auto-tuned. Do you want to hear it? Just so
I know, because
I know you want to
drop it.
Okay,
drop it.
Here it is.
"I knew something was wrong when a little pretty white girl ran into a black man's arms. Dad gave away. Dad gave away. My neighbor got big because we see this dude every day. We eat ribs with this dude, but we didn't have a clue that that girl was in that house.
Wow.
She said, please help me get out."
Oh, man.
I mean, wow. I got to give it up to the doc, though, in Boston, because, this was so damn tragic. And the whole thing, as it unwinds, it gets even worse when you think about it. Unfathomable how a man could do this to a woman and for years. And just to have a laugh at the end of all this, just to, take a breath and say, man, this at least give me a good feeling that there is hope.
But
Let me ask you about this. Let me ask you about this, though, because now, Arslan, I don't know where you were just you put on your forecasting cap, but you emailed earlier in the week to say no good deed is going to go unpunished. Just wait, and then it emerges that one of the websites, the Smoking Gun, reports that he has a criminal past. That Mr. Ramsey was convicted of domestic abuse. That he stands accused, and in fact was held accountable for hitting his wife. And there are other sort of issues there. So, does that change anything for you? I just want to ask how you feel about that.
Yeah, it was one of those things where I think I what I actually emailed you was that, you know, no good deed in America by a man of color goes unpunished. Mm. And this was a perfect example of that. You know, this does not take away from the heroic acts that he did, mm-hmm. You know, but it is going to be used by detractors to, you know, perpetuate stereotypes and mm-hmm. things like that.
Yeah, the first thing I did when I saw his name is I ran it through the clerk of courts, and I was like, oh, man, he's in big trouble.
Why did you do that?
Because I'm a reporter. That's why I did it. Yeah, I mean, I did the diligence right off the bat. But, you know, to everybody's point about Mike, I appreciate your point about the levity and the dead giveaway. But why is the misery of poor and disenfranchised, often people of color, why is that fodder for auto-tune? You know, Sweet Brown is running from her burning right. home, and Antoine Dawson trying to protect his sister who may or may not have been sexually assaulted. Now, this guy... You know, why is the misery of poor people, you know, entertainment fodder? He isn't a comedian. He's somebody in the midst of a very important emergency. And we're not laughing with him. We're laughing at him because we don't know him well enough to laugh with him. So I don't know.
One of the things I was responding to that he was saying wasn't, I was going a little different where he was talking about the fact that he had eaten ribs with this guy. He knew this guy. He had no idea what was going on there. I was responding to the fact that he was putting it all out there and he was saying, I can't understand how this is happening around me. Like, I'm not a fan of the autotune. I'm not putting him down that way. I was saying that it was easier to focus on his reaction than it was to focus on the crime because the crime is disgusting.
I'm puzzled by why you insist that people are laughing at him. And let me just for the sake of accuracy point out that there's another man, Angel Cordero, says he is the first person to help Amanda Berry. He was initially discovered by the Spanish language media. Now a lot of other people have interviewed him subsequently. It seems to me Amanda Berry can clear this all up at the appropriate time. I don't know just for what that's worth. Mm-hmm. But why are you so convinced that people are laughing at him?
Because he's not a comedian. He's somebody recounting something really ugly and scary that happened. And of course, he's signifying when he's doing it, and he's talking about he used to eat ribs with this dude. He's telling about the level of intimacy he had with his neighbor.
But maybe he's using humor in his own way to deal with the horror of the situation.
He's signifying about something very serious.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
And I appreciate that, but he's not a comedian.
Okay. I think we get it. You're listening to our weekly Barbershop Roundtable. We're joined by Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, journalist Michael Skolnick, healthcare consultant Dr. Neil Minkoff. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's keep it moving. And by keep it moving, apparently, I guess it has exercise and stuff involved with it, as it involves Chris Christie, because I'm pulling for dude, because the New Jersey governor acknowledged this week that he underwent weight loss surgery in February. Go get him, Christie. What do you say, Michelle?
Well, I don't know. What do you all say about this? One of the things I'm interested in, Arsalan, maybe I'll go to you first on this, and Neil, I certainly want to hear what you have to say as trained as a physician, is that, you know, with women, you know, we've kind of gotten to a point where, particularly people in politics, there's been a lot of discussion about whether you should be talking about people's appearance and weight. And somehow with him, it's like open season on him. People are allowed to talk about this, you know, all the time. I mean, he's continually making appearance on late night talk show comedians' roster of almost like required jokes. You'd think it was in the Constitution that people were required to joke about him. But on the other hand, this is a serious issue. So I don't know. What do you think about it?
Oh, I think don't hate the player, hate the game. I totally support Chris Christie in this. You know, if it's going to help his overall health prospect. I mean, at the end of the day, it's about him. You know, it's about his health and what he feels is necessary for himself as a person and for his family. You know, like you said, Michelle, he has become fodder. I mean, he famously went on David Letterman, you know, eating a donut, you know, and had been the butt of jokes for a long time. And I'm sure now people are going to look at him a little more seriously.
Right.
But he also has been rather defensive when other people have raised it. For example, do you remember this? When a former White House physician said that his weight was a problem and that she was hoping that he would address it before he ran for her name is Dr. Connie Mariano, and she was on this program actually earlier too. Here's what he said about that.
She must be a genius. She should probably be the Surgeon General of the United States, I suspect, because she must be a genius. I think this is just another hack who wants 5 minutes on TV.
Ouch. So he obviously was not
true,
pleased.
Though.
So Neil, what do you think?
So I had the opportunity. I was actually standing right next to Chris Christie up here in November at an event, and I was shocked at how much bigger he seemed without a suit coat on, not on TV, right directly in front of me. As a medical professional, I think it's a great thing as highlighting the problems with obesity and showing, especially as like kind of a tough guy, that it's okay as a tough guy to do something to take care of your weight and to take care of your family. I think that's a great message. I wonder if it's going to hurt his brand. I wonder if it's going to hurt his brand as the rambunctious, you know, heavy guy from New Jersey, kind of Soprano-esque that way, and whether it's going to, you know, because everybody kind of hints around that this is part of running for president, and it probably is, but I wonder if it's counterproductive.
You know,
but if I could just jump in.
Yeah, Michael.
If I could jump in. I got an issue with Christie, man. I got a real big issue with him because here he is on David Letterman the next day yelling at this doctor saying, you know, get out of here and, you know, making fun of being fat. And then a week later he gets his tummy tucked. And this, you know, he acts like a tough guy. He wants to be the tough guy. He's not a tough guy. And when Michelle Obama, our first lady, has an incredible program, Let's Move, Republicans just, you know, diss her and say what she's doing. She shouldn't be doing that. And she's actually trying to promote healthy living and childhood obesity. If he wants to do something good for this country and good for himself, then promote not being fat. Then promote being in shape. Then promote not eating donuts and David Letterman. It's not a joke. Like, there are a lot of young, heavy-set kids who are watching him who are saying, oh, I can eat donuts too because the governor's eating donuts.
Mike, did you just call Chris Christie a studio gangster?
I'm saying, it's like Mike came down from the Boogie Down Bronx with the intellectual brass knuckles on.
He just pulled a Udonis Haslam on him.
Gave him a whooping.
Okay, well, I have one more thing I wanted to run by you. And this bums me out. But Lakers superstar Kobe Bryant is getting attention for moves on another court. His mom is trying to sell some of his memorabilia from earlier in his career, when his high school career, and she's been paid an advance of about $500,000 for an auction house. Kobe says he did not give his mother permission for this, and she's just retaliating against him because he would not buy her not just any house,
but a
bigger house than the one he's already bought her. And then she says he says she's mad because she claims that he's bought his in-laws a nicer house. And I just, ugh. But I do wonder about this. Arsalan, you're the attorney here. Is that, does he have a case?
Well, first of all, this definitely gets the Redunculus Award of the week.
But on whose part? For who?
On both of them. On the mama's part, mainly. It's like, come on, Kobe's mom. You know, we all have parents that have done things that we have not liked. You know, when I was graduating from law school, I handed my mom my diploma, and she looked at me and she said, are you going to surprise me now and go to medical school?
Nice!
And it's like, you know, but she's still my mom, and I love her. And in this case, Kobe...
I think this is a little different,
Kobe,
just saying.
Kobe
just
offered to buy his parents a $250,000 house. They wanted, like, a $450,000 house. You know, the question remains, under whose ownership is the memorabilia currently? If it's sitting in a basement in the house of the parents, you know, a judge will have to decide, you know, is it still considered, quote-unquote, Kobe's property or not? But it's definitely the Redunculus Award of the week.
I'm sad about it. What about you, Jimmy?
I'm sad about it, too. I don't like to see, you know, families fight like this. Me and my mother had a very similar thing. She's trying to sell my typewriter, you know, to finance her next home. So far, there. So I already
bought it.
Oh, well.
Clickety clack.
Right.
And what are you going to buy with it? A smart car?
Or lunch.
I think Kobe's mag is not in the playoffs. Knicks play tomorrow night. Let's focus on a real team.
Oh,
wow.
Oh, ouch. With that being said, Jimmy Israel's a writer and culture critic. He's also adjunct professor of film and social media at Cuyahoga Community College. He was with us in D.C. Also in D.C., Arsalan Iftikhar, civil rights attorney and founder of themuslimguide.com. Michael Skolnick is editor-in-chief of globalgrind.com. That's a news and entertainment site founded by Russell Simmons, with us from our NPR bureau in New York. Neil Minkoff is a former doctor. He's now a healthcare consultant. He's a contributor to The National Review, with us from NPR member station WGBH in Boston. Thank you all so much.
Peace.
Happy Mother's Day to the mamas.
Thank you.
Hey, yep, yep.
And remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast. That's in the iTunes store or at npr.org. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.